abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, November 13th, 2013. Tom Woods here with Bob Murphy, Robert P. Murphy, one of your favorite economists, no doubt. And he is here by popular demand to take on a subject that you may have heard brought up in the media, certain sectors of the media. You may see circulated on Facebook, and a lot of people want to know, how do we answer it? And that is something called modern monetary theory, or MMT. And Bob is here to talk to us about it at a level that the layman can follow, and that I hope will help you guys understand this better and know what kind of response you ought to give when you're confronted with so-called modern monetary theory. Now, you know Bob Murphy. He's a great guy. He holds a PhD in economics from New York University. He's the author of many books, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, Chaos Theory, Lessons for the Young Economist, which is a textbook for young people on economics. You can get it for free online. And study guides for the major Austrian treatises, Human Action, Man, Economy, and State, The Theory of Money and Credit. And Bob joins us now to talk about modern monetary theory. Oh, by the way, his website, consultingbyrpm.com, and then click on his blog and follow him regularly. Bob Murphy, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Always good to be on your show.
Today I want to talk about modern monetary theory, just because I have gotten so many requests for this. You wouldn't believe it. I've got people specifically saying, number one, we want Murphy, and number two, we want to talk about MMT. Now, I mean, that to me, that just warms my heart that I have a listener base that, you know, is that knowledgeable, right? That they even know what this thing is. But the thing is, I get the sense that some people don't entirely understand what it is. And of those who do, they feel like, now that I understand it, I still feel like I must be missing something because something doesn't seem quite right about it. So you are going to be the guy who's going to do two things for us today. Number one is explain to us what modern monetary theory is. And then secondly, let's talk about what the shortcomings are. How should somebody answer when this comes up? But first of all, this seems to me like a relatively new school of thought. I mean, I'm not an economist, so maybe this has been percolating for a long time, but I don't remember 10 years ago anybody using the term modern monetary theory. So where'd this come from, and who are the people associated with it, first of all?
Well, I don't know exactly when the term modern monetary theory was coined, but the ideas in it, I think, would be considered part of the same worldview that Abel Lerner, for example, you know, the same person that was part of the socialist calculation debate and, referred sarcastically to Mises being a credit to the socialists for raising the issue. And then Lerner, of course, thought that he solved it with the market socialism solution. So a lot of the ideas that are associated with what we now call MMT actually go back to Abel Lerner. And so these ideas have been around. Nowadays, I think one of the leading gurus of the movement is this guy called Warren Mosler, and that's spelled Mosler. And he's the guy that I debated, for example, in Columbia University over the summer. And he was telling me, and I think he's okay with me sharing this. By the way, just incidentally, Tom, this guy is extremely charming. And so just be careful if you ever cross paths with him, he might convince you just with his natural witticisms, and then before you know it, you'll be advocating inflation.
Bob, if only people would say that of me someday. If you just meet Woods, he may, just through his sheer charm, win you over.
Well, you have to work on that then.
All right, go on.
So he was telling me that he actually thinks that the phrase modern monetary theory is a complete misnomer. He said, first of all, it's not modern, that these ideas have been around. he also said it's not really monetary, and unfortunately, I can't remember what his problem was with that term, whether he meant that it's also fiscal policy, or I think that might have been what it was, but I honestly can't remember. But there was some reason he was saying even the term monetary is not quite right. And then he said it's not really a theory, that, you know, it's a, if anything, a theorem, that are tautologies. So he was saying that he thinks the whole phrase is kind of silly, but, or I don't know if he said the word silly, saying it's a misnomer, but to answer your question, nowadays I think Mosler is the guy associated with it. And one thing I should be clear about is it is not the same thing as Keynesianism as the way Paul Krugman and Brad DeLong, guys like that, advocate. So MMT, in some respects from an Austrian perspective, might appear to be, oh yeah, that's just what those crazy Keynesians are saying, but actually, if you're going to put it on a spectrum, I think MMT is even more extreme, and in fact, even Krugman once in a while will occasionally point out that he differs from the MMT guys and that they only match up with the recommendations during what Krugman calls a liquidity trap.
All right, well, let's go back to the beginning here and set the stage this way. A lot of times you hear these MMT people say it is illegitimate, even though it may seem superficially plausible, it's illegitimate to compare your household budget with a government budget and say that the rules that constrain me in my household budget also constrain the government. They say that's not true. And I think, am I wrong to think that in talking about that comparison between a household budget and the government budget, that we are actually hitting on the real heart of what MMT is all about?
I think you're exactly right. And so, yeah, the way that I hear them express their views in particular, another big guy, by the way, is James Galbraith, if people know who that is.
Oh, I didn't know he was an MMT guy.
Yeah, I believe that he is. And with all this stuff, too, you get into different sects, just like if somebody said, well, who's an Austrian economist, and you and I might quibble about certain people, but I think in terms relative to everybody else, Galbraith is definitely closer to the MMT camp than the other camp.
Okay.
But the point they will make is when anybody like a politician or other more conventional economists, certainly Austrians, will complain about or worry about, hey, you know, the government is in the hole with all these liabilities with Social Security and Medicare and so forth, and this is really going to cause disaster down the road, and Americans need to wake up to these fiscal realities, saying things along those lines, or that, hey, Social Security is broke, that sort of language, their first response will be to roll their eyes and say, you guys are thinking as if we're on the gold standard still, and you don't realize that in modern times, with modern monetary and banking systems, with fiat money in particular, that's just not how it works anymore. And it's not true that governments have a budget constraint the same way that an individual household does. Because from the government's perspective, when they have to pay a bill, they just effectively credit the bank account of the individual in question or the creditor in question. And so there's no issue about them being able to meet all of their financial obligations because they can just issue more money. So this is the tie-in with the title or the description of modern monetary theory. They're trying to distinguish it from the system that ruled under the classical gold standard, when it really did make sense, they said, for governments to worry about being able to pay their bills.
So, all right, so they're saying then that governments are not subject to the type of constraints that you and I are, because you and I can't just create money to pay our bills? I mean, is that really what they're saying?
Yeah, I think that you just hit it on the head, that they're saying an individual is using currency issued by some other entity, whereas if we're referring to sovereign governments that have fiat currencies that they themselves issue, then they face no such constraints. And that's why they might contrast it and say the U.S. government is in a different position from, say, the country or the government of Spain, because they're part of the euro system, and so the Spanish government can't unilaterally just issue more euros, whereas they're claiming the U.S. government can unilaterally create more dollars. And so you do get into an issue of, well, they must be including the Federal Reserve and the federal government as part of the same entity.
Right.
So in case your listeners are confused about that step, that is the way the MMTers typically talk.
All right, so let's unpack this then. Would they admit that there could be some drawbacks to money creation? I mean, in other words, surely they would say that if the federal government or the Federal Reserve created, I don't know, just think of some astronomical amount of money and that they injected it right into the economy and it was being spent, that this would have negative consequences. But they would say that's a separate issue. The point is there's no constraint in terms of the government budget. Yes, there could be some unfortunate side effects of inflation, but that's a different issue? Or do they just deny, like, how do they handle the issue of inflation?
Yes, you, again, are correctly describing it. The more careful MMTers, so people like Mosler and others, the actual economists, the way they will phrase it is to say, don't get us wrong, if the government creates too much money, then yes, you will see prices rise. They would call that inflation, of course. At a rate that is undesirable, and so that might be a drawback to the policy. So we're not saying that there's no longer economic scarcity. What we're saying, though, is that it's the entire debates, as they typically unfold, people worrying about the government having the ability or say, for example, if someone proposes that the government spends money on some new program, the MMTers do not want someone to object and say, well, how are we going to pay for that? They think that that is a silly question that's no longer relevant because, of course, the government can pay for that. It can just create money and pay for it that way. And they will say that, no, the only issue is, will this cause too much inflation or more inflation than we desire? So they do, like I say, if they're careful, and especially if you press them on it, they will concede, oh, right, if we create too much money, then we'll have more inflation than we want. But they still think that they're setting the issues up properly and giving us the proper framework within which to have a policy discussion by getting rid of this silly idea that the government can't afford certain things.
Well, what is your response to that? I mean, to me, this seems like a silly thing to want to emphasize, because I suppose I could yield to them in a very technical sense that, yes, I understand that the federal government has a monopoly on money creation, and yes, it can create a lot of money, whatever, but I still, nevertheless, feel like there are, at some level, there are constraints to, let's say, building 15 colonies on Mars, you know, that would take trillions of dollars. Yeah, I mean, I suppose the U.S. government could print up the money for that, but how helpful is it to emphasize that aspect of the question when the more relevant aspect of the question is, does the rest of society really want to see its resources transferred to this institution on that scale?
I, again, agree with you totally here, Tom. I think at this point my presence on your show is superfluous.
Well, I'm just groping my way through this stuff here, Bob. I mean, I'm glad I'm hitting a bullseye every time, but I assure you, I don't really know that much about this. I'm just going on what you're telling me and just trying to see what I think a guy on the street would say in response.
Right. So what you just said a minute ago is exactly how I dealt with it. And for your listeners, if you just go to YouTube and say Robert Murphy, Warren Mosler debate Columbia with a U, because it's Columbia University, I'm sure you'll see it if you're curious to see the actual debate we had. But you're right. He laid out his position. Actually, he didn't lay it out. He just went right into his policy recommendations. And then I tried to make sure everybody in the crowd and online knew what his position was, and the way I dealt with it was exactly as you just tried to do. And I said, yes, there is a sense in which everything he's laying out in his book, and his book is called Seven Deadly Innocent Frauds of Economic Policy, if people want to look that up. And I said, yes, there's a sense in which the points you're making, or at least many of them, are technically accurate. And I said, but to me, it seems like that's not really changing the fundamentals of the discussion. And so I used an analogy. And I said, suppose there's a couple, and they're looking over their bills at the dinner table, and the wife is really stressed out, and she says, you know, honey, with the amount you're making from your job and all these bills that we owe and so forth, I don't think we're making ends meet, and I'm going to have to start taking a job and bring in some income as well, because I don't see how this is going to work. And then imagine if the guy said, no, dear, you're thinking in terms of the gold standard. You're thinking this Ozzie and Harriet notion that there's a household budget constraint. We are constrained by the amount of income we bring in. I can just go put on a ski mask and start holding up 7-Elevens and get more money that way. And the wife says, what are you, crazy? I mean, if you start doing that, you're going to get arrested and go to prison. And he'll say, oh, yeah, I'm not denying that there are drawbacks to my recommendation, but what I'm saying is you're wrong to be focusing on how we need to boost our reportable income. What I'm saying is, you know, really the only constraint on what we can buy is when the police are going to arrest me and how many 7-Elevens I can get away with knocking over. Right? So is what the husband said incorrect? Did he lie to her? Is what he said wrong in terms of accounting and the reality of the way the world is now in a world of, you know, being able to rob 7-Elevens and so forth? Well, no. I mean, what he said technically is true, but does that really change the way the wife is thinking about it? And is that really a realistic thing to take into account? Or is it pretty much fine for her to be saying, if we want to keep spending like this, then we're going to have to, I'm going to have to take a second job. We're going to have to figure out a way to boost our income. So that's kind of my reaction to the MMT people, that if it is true to say that just through regular tax revenues and possibly running budget deficits and borrowing, that the government can't possibly live up to the spending obligations it's committed to, then you don't really change that reality by saying, oh, wait a minute, but there's a printing press right here, so make sure you guys don't leave that out of the equation. But then it just means, okay, the people are paying for it through higher prices and having dollar-denominated assets become worth less in real terms. So the public is still paying for it, and if they don't want to pay for it without use of the printing press, all it's going to do is possibly make them not realize how much they're being ripped off with the printing press. But it doesn't mean all of a sudden these programs are now more affordable.
Well, now, if you're saying that the MMT people feel like they're, by making these points about the government's unique ability to, because it can create money, its unique ability to pay for things in ways that you and I can't pay for things, and so there isn't a constraint on the government in the way there's a constraint on us. If you're saying they're laying this out in order to set the stage for policy discussion, where do they take this? Where do they go with this insight? Because on a very technical level, we can concede to them this point. As you say, I mean, it's not strictly wrong. It's just that it begs every important question. Well, where do they then go with it?
Right. So you're right there. And I should warn people that, unfortunately, my unbridled honesty gets me into trouble, because after I said that in the debate, not Mosler himself, again, Mosler, I mean, he's really a cool guy, and it's just, I think his ideas are nutty, but a lot of the MMT people went to the airwaves and the blogs and stuff and said, oh my gosh, within the first 8 minutes, Murphy just conceded the entire debate. He said that Mosler was right, end of story, and that, you know, Murphy just has personal qualms about liberty and printing money and counterfeiting, as he calls it, blah, 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 but he conceded Warren's right. So when you say that, yes, technically, you guys are correct. In an age of fiat money, no government ever has to tell a creditor we lack the means to pay you our contractual obligations. Then they're going to say that you've conceded. But of course, as you're bringing up here, Tom, that doesn't really change the nature of the fact that if governments are spending too much, then they're spending too much. And you're right. Where they take it is invariably, they say the government should be spending more. So Mosler in particular, he has all sorts of recommendations, including he thinks the federal government should pledge to give everyone a job who wants a job. At a certain, off the top of my head, I don't remember what the hourly wage rate was, because he's saying there's no reason for there to be involuntary unemployment at this point. So the government can just pay everyone to do it. And in his mind, that will just give people a chance to then find a better job in the private sector. I mean, he's not assuming that that half of America is going to be on the dole indefinitely. But the point is that that's just one of several of his proposals that sound like it's an incredible potential transfer of resources from the private sector into the hands of politicians and bureaucrats to be doled out to various people of their choosing. So yes, if they were just making the technical point, then called for massive spending cuts, that would be one thing. But what they do is they say, look, at right now, price inflation is very moderate. We have slack demand. There's excess capacity. The factories are idle. There's millions of people looking for work. So clearly, the government could get away with creating a bunch more money that wouldn't lead to massive price increases, so there'd be no downside to it. And it's just this obsolete gold standard thinking is preventing the politicians from having the wisdom to go ahead and put everyone back to work. And so you crazy Austrians and other gold bugs need to stop tying their hands thinking, oh, we can't afford it, when clearly the problem right now is that we need more people to go to work. That might be one way of putting it, is that they're saying, when they look at the economy right now, they see unemployed workers, and so in their mind, the government could just spend money that it creates out of thin air and get them back to work, and then real output increases. And so clearly, that has to be a good outcome, and we don't need to worry about making sure the accounts balance, because the government can always just create more money, so that's not the issue.
Now, let's suppose, though, we granted them. Let's say we said, all right, let's even leave out of account the subject of price inflation. Let's say that we concede that that's not a problem. From the Austrian standpoint, there are other problems that are associated with the idea that you just create money and there's slack demand for reasons that are never explained. There are idle resources that are idle for reasons that are never explained. We'll just create money out of thin air, and then like a lubricant, it'll get the whole machine running again. An Austrian just doesn't think that way. I mean, price inflation or no, that's another matter. And Austria doesn't look at the economy this way, like it's a single entity, like it's a thing, it's like an ignition that needs to be turned. So can you maybe talk like an Austrian here in talking out exactly what's wrong with the way they're thinking about this?
Sure. So from an Austrian perspective, if we had a regular economy that was in a normal equilibrium, let's say, where things were running smoothly, and then the government were to come on the scene and create a bunch of new money and start buying things and giving money to the military, let's say, so they start cranking out more tanks and giving money to other construction companies to start building bridges and highways and what have you, and giving money to other people for food stamps or whatever it is. The point is that would redirect resources from where they originally would have gone into now the channels that the government picks. And so clearly you would, from an Austrian perspective, you say that can't be a good outcome, because there are many reasons for thinking that the private sector and voluntary transactions are the best way to allocate resources. And so one way of expressing that is to say, the way that a Keynesian would say, oh yeah, okay, sure, you're saying if there's already full employment, then there's crowding out and there are trade-offs. And if the government wants to increase government output, then the private sector has to restrict its output. Fair enough. So now the issue is, but what if there's slack capacity? What if there's unemployment when this scenario unfolds? But you're right, Tom, that even there, the Austrians are going to say, well, no, you have to ask, why is there this involuntary unemployment in the first place? And it's because of the fallout from a previous unsustainable boom. And that it's because of a previous bout of inflation coming in through the credit markets that lowered interest rates below where they should have been, that misled entrepreneurs. They started longer projects than there were enough real savings to finance. And at some point, you hit a wall physically. It's not just a matter of having enough dollars or whatever the monetary unit is, that there are physical constraints in the structure of production, in the capital structure, and that leads to a situation where the authorities either have to back off or else the currency collapses. Either way, that unsustainable boom is unsustainable and it will end, and that's what leads you to the depression or recession in modern parlance. And so it takes time for those unemployed resources to get redirected back into useful niches, and the government, if it comes in while they're still idle and just tries to print up a bunch of money and get everybody back to work, it just short circuits that recovery process.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So let me jump in here, because we had G.P. Manish on a few weeks ago. He was talking about Keynesianism, and he made a valuable distinction between what you might call physical idleness and economic idleness. Yeah, it's true that some factory may be physically idle; it's not in use, or a hotel. Maybe it closes for one season of the year. It's physically idle. But can you say it's economically idle? I mean, is there really no economic purpose served by withholding its services? I mean, is the owner a complete idiot? Or might he have some reason for doing what he's doing? And so what you're describing is a situation in which the owners of a lot of these resources are trying to figure out exactly where they fit into the structure of production right now. In the wake of the bust, they need to rearrange things, and so they need to watch and see where, how they fit in, right?
Exactly. And even in normal times, even in a purely free market where there were no boom-bust cycle, at any given moment, there would be workers in between jobs. And there would be, if a business goes out of business because that particular entrepreneur miscalculated what the demand would be or he miscalculated what the costs would be, whatever. And so, like a commercial building that has a bunch of little stores in it, at any given moment, one of those units might be vacant. And they would have a sign up saying office space for rent with the phone number. And so you have to ask, well, why don't they just rent it out immediately the next day so that there's no discontinuity and output from these various things? And it's because the owner, the landlord of that building, of course, wants to hold out to get a tenant in there to get a better price for it. And if he just had to rent it out immediately, he'd have to drop the price pretty drastically. And so he leaves it vacant while people are searching. And the same thing with workers. If you quit your job or get laid off, you don't just take the first job offer. You're driving down the street and see McDonald's is hiring. You previously were an engineer, you're not going to take that job right away, even though technically you could be working the next week. And so because you hold out and you send your resume around and you look for a better spot. So that sort of search process happens all the time, and that's going to happen even in a normal free market economy. It's just that in the wake of a massive government distortion with interest rates that screws everything up, when the entrepreneurs realize that, it takes them longer to adjust. And the best solution to that is for the government to stop interfering and let the market do its work.
Bob, any parting thoughts on modern monetary theory? Do you feel like we hit everything, or is there anything we left out? In terms of a basic overview, of course.
Well, I guess one thing I would like to take on is one of the ways they try to show how silly the conventional approach is they'll say they have this apparently wise statement that says, the only way for the private sector to accumulate net financial assets is for the government to run a budget deficit, right? Because the way they're thinking about it, and you can do it with various forms of accounting, is they're saying if you divide the world up into the government sector and then the private sector, only if the government runs a deficit and so owes the rest of the world money can the rest of the world then increase what it is owed. You see how that works?
Yeah.
And so they think that's a very profound statement to show that, no, see, you guys are crazy. If you want the government to run a balanced budget, or even worse, to run a budget surplus, then that necessarily decreases net financial assets held by the private sector. So you're crazy. And there's various flaws with that, but one way to see it is just to say, look, suppose the government comes up to me and gives me $1 million IOU. So I'm holding a treasury bond that Uncle Sam's going to give me $1 million, so I feel rich. You're right. I have $1 million more now. My net financial assets have gone up. Now next year, to pay that off, Uncle Sam points a gun at me, takes $1 million from me at gunpoint, and then redeems that bond and gives me $1 million and takes the treasury back. So there you go. We just paid you. Clearly, that process didn't make me richer. And that's what happens in the aggregate when the government runs a budget deficit with the rest of the world. And then we say, oh, the rest of the world now is richer. How is the government going to redeem those bonds just by taxing the rest of us? And so it's just completely ludicrous when you think through the implications of what they're saying, and yet they run around with these accounting tautologies that, yes, technically are accurate mathematically, but how they deploy them in policy discussions is completely misleading.
Well, Bob, we're going to have to leave it there. We're just about out of time, but I appreciate you coming on and tackling this. I can't think of anybody better to do it. And as I say, I was very surprised at how many requests I got for this, and you're quite a good sport just having returned to the country not too long ago to come on here and be so fresh and zippy and right on target. I sure appreciate it. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Bob is going to be teaching a 4-week course on the economics of Obamacare. You can take that by going to academy.mises.org. But hurry, it starts November 20th. And don't forget, libertyclassroom.com is open 24 hours a day. It's got 8 courses up there that you can learn from in your car, taught by me and by others I trust. We got our 9th course coming very, very soon. The history of political thought from a libertarian perspective. All kinds of fun stuff. Real history, real economics. And also, if you want to learn Austrian economics, go to learnaustrianeconomics.com. And if you want to help out our little show here, help me keep my office, then at no cost to you, by entering Amazon.com on our show site, which is TomWoodsRadio.com. You can help us keep the lights on. And you can donate bitcoins if they're burning a hole in your virtual pocket. All right, that's it for today, everybody. David Friedman tomorrow. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.